This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After what happened 4 years ago, everybody wants to Florida-proof this year's election, especially Florida. But in the battle against butterfly ballots and dangling chads, there are fresh concerns about the new procedures and equipment, and with the legitimacy of the electoral process still in question, credibility is in short supply. In a few minutes, we'll talk about some of the new election procedures around the country. We'll hear from a commissioner of the agencies that's issued a best practices toolkit to help election officials, and we'll talk about electronic voting machines, which some fear could be less reliable than paper ballots. Later in the program, an update on today's events in Najaf, and we'll hear what callers are saying on Baghdad's talk radio station. But first, election 2004, ready or not. If you have questions about provisional or absentee ballots, early voting, touch screens, or the training of poll workers, give us a phone call. Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we start in the state that will once again, whether it wants to or not, be in the spotlight in 2004 on Election Day, and that, of course, is Florida. Joining us from the offices of the Miami Herald, where he's executive editor, is Tom Fiedler, and good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thanks for having me, Neil.
Your state is going a long way to make sure that the problems of 2000 are not repeated. Give us an idea of some of the reforms that have been instituted.
Well, it probably won't take much to remind people that Florida came out of 2000 as a national embarrassment. In your lead-in, you were talking about the chads. We had the dimple chads and the pregnant chads, and the famous picture of the judge doing the post-count recount, staring up into the light to try to see whether there was a dimple there or not. So the state was absolutely determined that it would move from being a laughingstock to being the best practices for the country. And step one in that was doing away with all of the punch cards in those counties that use them, which included the largest counties, Miami-Dade being among them. Mm-hmm. And we switched very rapidly into the what seemed to be the cutting-edge technology, the coming thing, which was the touch screen, similar to ATM machines. And so the concern, however, is that in that shift, all of the debugging that may have been necessary, that might be necessary, hasn't been completed. And you couple that concern over a failure of this new technology with a very real, if not growing, sense of skepticism among many voters that the election is going to be conducted on the up and up. And it's cause for a great deal of concern.
Well, there was one experiment, or I guess tryout earlier this year, didn't turn out that well.
That's right. There have been a number of tryouts, but the one that you're referring to was with a local election in Homestead, which is a town of 25,000, just lies between Miami and the Florida Keys. And they had a local election there in which there was a concern about going back and doing a recount, as the law requires when it's close. And to the embarrassment of the election officials who use this, the new touchscreen technology, they couldn't locate the electronic database on which the votes were cast, and admitted this. So for several days, there was quite a concern that there was, in effect, not only no paper trail to go back and check on an election, but there was not even a virtual trail. But to the relief of the local officials here, that once the technicians came in from the company that provided the touchscreen machines, they were able to reconstruct the results, and they did find that the votes cast. But again, the concern here that people are at the mercy of technicians in what could be an election as close as we saw in 2000, it really is a formula for, I guess, impending crisis.
Another thing that's supposed to resolve some of the problems we saw in year 2000, and this not just in Florida, but in many places around the country, is provisional balloting. In other words, if you go to your polling station and for some reason you find your name isn't listed, you can go cast a provisional ballot, and they'll figure out later whether you're qualified to vote or not.
That's right. And that also was instituted here in Florida in the aftermath of 2000. There were many, many voters, and particularly this happened in precincts where you had a high concentration of minority voters, particularly African Americans and Haitian Americans, people who showed up to cast a ballot in that in the Al Gore George Bush race in 2000 and were told that their name was not on the rolls in that precinct. And in many cases, these people were not allowed to cast a ballot. So what the provisional ballot allows you to do is exactly as you said. It allows you to go to that polling place. If you do believe that you are legitimately registered, then you will be given that ballot. You'll be allowed to go ahead and complete it as anyone else. But it'll be held aside, like absentee ballots, until a check is made to make sure that you didn't just come up the street from another precinct and do the same thing there. So that's the idea, and it was a direct result of the concern that many had after 2000 that they were just disenfranchised because of bureaucratic paper shuffling.
Our number, if you'd like to join our conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And Shanna joins us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is this. If I'm going to the polls, which I am, how do I know that everything's on the up and up and that my vote is being registered? What can a person going to the polls look out for on Election Day?
And I should point out there's early voting now allowed in Florida for the upcoming statewide primary. Is that where you're where you're planning to go to vote, Shanna?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Tom Fever.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things you can do. I'm not sure whether Duval County, Jacksonville, has the touchscreen machines or whether you'll be using the optical scan machines. But if it is the touchscreen machines and you are going to take advantage of the early balloting, what you will be able to do is go to, maybe a half a dozen locations around the Jacksonville area. Generally, these are libraries and so forth, and your election supervisor's office will have those. You will go into that polling place, and it'll be set up exactly as it would be on Election Day, but with one important difference, and that is that these regional polling places that are done for the advanced balloting, because they consolidate a number of precincts in them, you've got to be sure that when they turn on the machine that you will be using, they actually have a cartridge-like thing that they stick in the machine, that they designate your proper precinct in there. Now, what happened here in Miami-Dade a few days ago when early voting started here, a candidate for state legislature went to one of these regional centers, hoping, of course, to cast a ballot for himself, and went to the machine, and the poll worker just mistakenly put in an incorrect precinct number, and so the legislator, or the candidate rather, to his horror, couldn't even find his own name there. When he raised a protest, they discovered the problem. So step number one, make sure if you do early voting that the ballot that you get is for the precinct in which you are registered.
Well, it sounds like the answer to Shanna's question is about how can she be sure is, I don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Shanna.
Bye.
Let me ask, if you didn't have enough problems already, obviously Hurricane Charley is the aftermath, causing a lot of power problems, among other things, in certain parts of the states. You've got the primary coming up at the end of the month.
That's right. On August 31st is the first primary here, and it will involve voting for the U.S. Senate on both the Republican and the Democratic side. And, of course, there are a number of congressional and other races that will be settled then.
Now, getting back to the electronic machines that you were describing, did Florida buy the kind that gives the paper receipt that publishes something on paper so that these machines can be checked, or is it the kind that doesn't publish the paper receipt?
Sadly, the latter, Neil, and this has become quite an issue. Again, it ties in with the skepticism, if not the outright cynicism, that a lot of people have that this election will be conducted on the up and up. These machines do not give a paper receipt, so a voter is literally left with nothing more than faith that when you touch the candidate's name on the screen and then later you hit the vote button to make it work, that the electrons all lined up like you intended, and that ballot gets virtually cast as you intended it to be. I think there's something comforting about being able to walk out of any place where you've done an electronic transaction, whether it's at the automated teller machine at your bank, or when you go to the local convenience store to get gasoline and it asks you whether you want a receipt or not. I think just a lot of people automatically do, even though they know they've gotten the gas or whatever their price was. It's just something about having that, and the lack of it here in Florida, again, added against the backdrop of the history here in 2000 and the ongoing concern, the lack of that receipt has been quite an issue. In fact, it's being batted about in Congress now.
Well, Tom Fiedler, we know you've got Charlie and a bunch of other things to keep you busy. We appreciate your time today.
I enjoyed being on. Thanks, Neil.
Tom Fiedler, executive editor of the Miami Herald, and he joined us from his office in Miami, Florida. Well, joining us now is Doug Chapin, director of electionline.org. That's a nonpartisan website that provides news and analysis on election reform. Doug Chapin, normally based in Washington, we reached him on vacation, and he kindly joins us today from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good day, Neil. Thanks for having me.
The problems that Tom Fiedler has been talking about in Florida, the concerns about the electronic voting machines, the wrong precincts being loaded into the machines, provisional ballots, are these being experienced elsewhere in the country?
They are indeed. I mean, Florida really has been, ever since 2000, a poster child for election reform, both in identifying the problem, as we saw so vividly in November of 2000, but also in trying to respond to the problem. But some of the difficulties they're facing with electronic voting, with provisional balloting, access to electronic data, are being repeated in other states across the country. So the bad news is that Florida's probably not alone, but the good news is, at least from Florida's perspective, that they might have company in the spotlight this fall.
What about that cynicism that he was talking about? Is there concern outside of Florida that people have that machines either may not work properly or, let's put it bluntly, may have been rigged?
I think the cynicism does exist. I don't know if I would go so far as to say that most people believe they're rigged. There is a tremendous understanding now of the nuts and bolts of the electoral process, and I think people more so than ever are concerned that the vote they put in the front of the machine is the same as the vote that comes out of the back of the machine. And as people become familiar with the internet and computers and both the positives and the negatives of that experience, I think they bring that experience to the voting process and sometimes have the same concerns.
How many states are going with electronic touchscreen voting this time around? And I know it's a patchwork in a lot of states, too.
It's very much a patchwork, and I don't have the hard data in front of me, but it's somewhere along the lines of 30 jurisdictions in all or part of 30 states will be using electronic voting of some kind this fall.
And then there's some using the optical scan machines.
That's right. The optical scan machines, anyone who's ever taken a standardized test, whether it be the ACT or the SAT, will be familiar with optical scan machines. One either fills in a bubble or connects an arrow on a piece of paper, which is then read by a machine to cast the vote.
Mm-hmm. And we should point out, and some places are still using paper ballots and old-fashioned voting machines like they, I guess, still have in New York City. But we should point out that all of these election laws and all of these different devices are purchased locally. These are quite to local and state regulations, correct?
That's correct. After the 2000 election, one of the first instincts, at least in the policy community, was maybe that we needed to have a more federal approach to elections. And after the various task forces and study groups out there took a look at the problem, the consensus emerged that we should leave the system essentially the way it is, which is largely in the hands of local election officials, but in many states in the hands directly of state officials.
We're going to have more with Doug Chapin of electionline.org and more of your calls and emails. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, that'll work, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the election reforms many states have adopted as they prepare for this fall's presidential election. What's your community doing to ensure all goes smoothly on Election Day? enough. 800-989-8255. Talk. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Doug Chapin, director of electionline.org, which is a non-advocacy website that provides news and analysis on election reforms. And let's get some more callers on the line. John is with us from Delaplaine, Virginia.
Good afternoon, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your previous expert, the guy from Florida, made a couple of interesting comments. I developed software for a living. I've been doing it for 25 years. The basic fact of the matter is there is no such thing as bug-free software. No matter what we do, even the very simplest applications, once they're placed in the hands of the user, they figure out ways to break them that we can't possibly figure. You know, we sometimes can't even reproduce them. So there, I wondered if your studio people have comments on that, and the general inaccuracy seems to me. And I write software. Like I say, I'd rather have a paper ballot, or even if the state organizations or the local organizations recorded and sent you back a report of what your vote was. You know, something to validate is almost going to be necessary for using electronic voting systems.
Doug Chapin.
The caller has an excellent point, and one of the things we've seen over the last couple of years is almost a product development cycle for electronic voting in real time with real dollars. The early adopters in Florida, in Georgia, and elsewhere are now struggling with public concerns about security and the like and are responding accordingly. The state of Nevada has required the paper trail that Mr. Fiedler described and are trying to get it ready in time for this fall. We've also seen other companies developing alternatives to the raw paper trail, whether it be some sort of cryptographic solution where a voter would be able to log in later on and verify that his or her vote was cast as counted, or a new breed of hybrid machines which marry the convenience of touchscreen machines with the assurance of optical scan machines and allow a voter to cast a ballot on the touchscreen but have it actually recorded on an optical scan ballot. So there's a lot going on out there, and the election administrators and the voters they serve are probably in the middle of not just using but testing those machines, not just in real time, but with real ballots.
John, thank you.
Thank you.
And we're having difficulties with the line from St. Paul, Minnesota, and we're working on that, and we apologize, but that's why the level of Doug Chapin keeps getting louder and softer. We apologize for that. We're working on it. Mary Medley emails us from Portland, Oregon. As you know, Oregon has a full vote-by-mail system. Each county has its own method. For example, she writes, Multnomah County, the largest, which includes Portland, uses what our household refers to as the SAT ballot, fill in the bubble with a number 2 pencil. Same method the county used for years before going to vote by mail, back when I worked as a volunteer poll worker, 20-plus years younger than any of the other poll workers. The system, she says, works well, scans the ballot, records the votes. Only those that are not clearly marked have to be manually checked.
Well, an excellent point, and there are lots of people who are quite fond of the optical scan ballots. The problem with optical scan, or really any paper-based system, is that it has the potential to disenfranchise voters with visual disabilities, specifically blind voters, because they cannot see the ballot. They have difficulty in ensuring that the vote was cast as counted, and you hear advocates in Washington and elsewhere talk about having poll workers wonder aloud why they were voting for the person they'd been asked to vote for and the like. So part of what the new federal act, the Help America Vote Act, does is require states and localities to come up with accessible voting systems. And these touchscreen machines, which have generated such controversy, are part of that intended response.
As we've been hearing this hour, a lot of people have concerns about the accuracy and transparency of touchscreen machines. One person who's made it her mission to investigate possible problems with electronic voting is Bev Harris, executive director of Black Box Voting, an election watchdog group. That's what it is. She joins us on the line now from Sacramento, California. Good to speak with you today.
Hi there.
I know you travel around the country talking with voting machine manufacturers and election officials about electronic voting, and you have, in fact, discovered a few flaws in some of the systems. What's made you take this up as your passion?
Well, I've actually been a writer for many years, and for about 4 years I was doing writing assignments where I was dealing with embezzlement and financial fraud. And, of course, I was very familiar with various kinds of auditing procedures that are needed. And as I looked at the current voting systems, what immediately jumped out to me was that we were taking away the audit. And you see, if you take away the audit, which is just the way of showing your work, or in other words, you're adding up a bunch of numbers and you want to be able to show to the voters that your work is correct, if you take away those checks and balances and take away auditability, then you are opening the door for fraud. And knowing human nature, having done the work with, in terms of covering embezzlement and so forth, I knew that there are a certain percentage of people who are vulnerable to pressure and who are likely to walk through those open doors if you leave them open.
Mm-hmm. Human nature being what it is.
Yes.
Now, when you discover these flaws and glitches in whatever system you're looking at, I assume you bring them to the attention of the manufacturers and election officials. What's been their response?
Some of them are very, very good and are equally disturbed and really want something done. We also, with the manufacturers, not so much. There are, unfortunately, there is too much money at stake for the short, quick profit. There, when the Help America Vote Act allocated about $4 billion to manufacturers, basically to buy these machines, there became this gold rush, and you had a bunch of for-profit companies really running after the dollar without necessarily having the systems in place to really count the vote properly.
Mm-hmm. But election officials, you found, look for ways to solve the problem?
Election officials have a tough job. I mean, it's people don't realize how very, very stressful it is to run an election. When we privatized the counting of the vote and turned it over to these private manufacturers, And we also went high-tech, it made the election officials completely dependent on the vendors' technicians in order to successfully pull off an election.
Hmm.
So you see, they've got a problem because they literally cannot put on an election without these machines now, and they cannot pull it off without without friendly relations with the vendors' technicians. So we've got a situation where nobody's quite sure what to do to solve the problem, and you know, certainly what's going to be required is much more robust auditing procedures. And interestingly, the vendors don't seem to really want more robust auditing. I think one reason may be that we've uncovered so many instances where the machines have actually miscounted. And if you audit much more carefully, you're going to find more miscounts, and that's going to reflect on their bottom line.
Okay. Bev Harris, so you were in Sacramento, I assume, to talk with California officials.
Yes, I'm here to talk with members of the Secretary of State's office at their behest. About a new problem that surfaced with both optical scan and touchscreen machine tabulators.
Well, hang in there. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bev Harris, Executive Director of Black Box Voting, an election watchdog group. She joined us on the phone from Sacramento, California. She mentioned the Help America Vote Act of 2002. The act led to the creation of the Election Assistance Commission, a clearinghouse that provides guidance and expertise to thousands of election officials around the country. The commission has just come out with a best practices toolkit that's being made available to those officials and to, in fact, anybody who wants to check out their website, eac.gov. Joining us here in Studio 3A to talk about this new report is one of those commissioners, Paul DiGregorio, Election Assistance Commissioner. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon, Neil.
And I know that one of the things that your toolkit deals with is these new electronic machines and dealing with vendors.
Yes, it does. It does very much so.
And that's going to be a problem because all of this is new or relatively new.
Yes, Neil, we've seen a lot of new changes, as Doug Chapin mentioned earlier. There's been a lot of changes that have taken place since 2000. There's a lot of new laws, new regulations, and new technology that's been introduced since that election in November of 2000.
Well, what should, is Bev right? Are electoral officials now, or election officials, at the mercy of these technicians from the vendors?
Well, some of them may be. Those election officials who rely on the vendors, perhaps too much so, may be at their mercy, but this best practices document encourages them not to be, and it gives them some practical advice on how they can take care of their election machinery in such a way that they can audit it or they can have it tested independently to make sure that the equipment is secure. One of the recommendations, one of the major recommendations in this report, is to have every election official and every vendor to place their software at the National Software Reference Library here in Gaithersburg, Maryland, it's a National Institute of Standards and Technology. It has a reference library that they use all the time for various other purposes, and we're encouraging election officials to place that software in this library. And what it does is, Neil, is that when they program for the election, and they place the software there after the election, they can go right back and bring the software back after the election and see if there's been any changes made to it. And there's scientists there that can check what they call the hash marks to see if there's been any changes, any tampering that's gone on with the software in between.
More perhaps mundane problems that you point out in your report. Too few poll workers and some, you say, are too old.
Well, we don't exactly say that in the report, but the average age is 72, and these are great Americans who provide tremendous services. And Neil, we have 193,000 polling places in the country that's going to serve about 110, 120 million people. And we need between 1.5 and 2 million people. I was the director of elections in St. Louis County, Missouri for 8 years. I know every presidential election. We were down to the wire before Election Day to try to fill all 5,000 spots that we had to fill. And I know election officials around the country are in dire need. And with the new technology, many people who've worked at the polls before don't want to do it now. And we do have a shortage, and we've encouraged people. We had 300-400 hits on our website last week. So some people, we have a little click on there where people can be become a poll worker, and we channel them to their states. But it is something that's needed, and we have a college program that we're going to roll out next month to encourage college students and even high school students to serve as poll workers in this country.
Do you have to be old enough to vote to work as a poll worker?
Well, in some states you have to be. In most states you have to be a registered voter in that state. But there are some states that have exceptions where high school students can serve as assistants, so they can check in voters as they come in the door to polling places, and they have done that in many jurisdictions across the country, and we certainly encourage that.
Okay, stay with us, and we'll talk with Doug Chapin as well, but we want to get some more listeners involved in the conversation. Judy's with us from Berkeley, California.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Okay. I just wanted to say that in California, we can cast voter-verified paper ballots, and I intend to do so on November 2nd. I intend to do that by voting absentee. But if people would prefer, they are all able to cast a voter-verified paper ballot in the polling place on Election Day. Our Secretary of State, Kevin Shelley, has required that polling places that do use the paperless touchscreen machines make available to voters who prefer the option of casting a voter-verified paper ballot. So there's no requirement to use those machines, and people should be aware of that.
In some places in California. Is that right, Doug Chapin?
That's right. In some places, it's generally statewide.
Throughout
in California.
Yes,
Secretary Shelley has been very aggressive in responding to security concerns. And one of the things that he has done is provisionally certified these machines and required both vendors and local election officials to respond in ways, including the way mentioned by your caller.
Mm-hmm. And also the absentee ballots, that's obviously not just in California. A lot of people I know in Florida are talking about voting absentee.
That's correct. The problem with that, though, is that as with many things, the state law varies place to place as to whether or not one is eligible for what's called a no-fault absentee ballot. In my home state of Virginia, there is not such an animal, meaning that you can't go to the a polling place and say, I want an absentee ballot just because I want one. You have to have a reason, meaning that you'll be out of town or unable to get to the polls that day. So not every voter in every state will have the option that voters in California do.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Judy.
Thank you.
We're talking about election reforms as voting day approaches. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk with Patricia in Norman, Oklahoma.
Yes, hi. How are you doing today?
Okay.
Good. What I wanted to ask was this. Well, here in Oklahoma, we have the scanned voting, I guess, where you connect the two parts of the arrow.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that my vote was being counted because I see the number change when I put it in the machine, but that doesn't necessarily mean that my vote's being counted correctly. But what my question was, are we as citizens allowed to be at the polls at closing time when the votes are counted? I mean, I don't know how they do it. Do they take the, you know, like here in Oklahoma, like I said, we have the basically paper ballots, I guess, we have where you connect the mm-hmm. arrow. Do they take those out at the end of the night and count them at the precinct? And are we as citizens allowed to be there when those votes are counted, because that way you can take down the number of votes that, you know, are recorded, and then the next day you can check the newspaper or on the Internet to see if those votes are still recorded correctly as you, you know, watch the count that night before.
Now, Paul DiGregorio, do you have an answer to that?
Oklahoma is rather unique because it's the only state in the nation that all voters in Oklahoma use the optical scan system. In other states, they have Maryland and Georgia uses the touchscreen systems. But she raises a good point. And it varies from state to state who can observe the count of the vote. In most cases, it's the political parties that have the opportunity to do that. Many states allow the candidates or their representatives to be there for the count. And there's a few that allow the public and certainly the media can be there to watch the count of the vote. But we always encourage election officials to make the process as transparent as possible, to allow transparency at the polling place and certainly transparency as the votes are being counted and processed to be counted, too, because I think it's very important for the voters to have confidence in the system. And the only way they're going to do that is to have a process that's open and transparent.
Okay. Good question, Patricia. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see if we get one more in. Dave is with us from Rockland, California.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. In the book The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Greg Pallas talks about the felon lists, and there's some controversy about how they were handled. And I guess I'm wondering, in addition to technological stuff, what are we doing to make sure that the felons are handled accurately? Because if this vote comes down to a couple hundred people, those votes really can matter, too.
Am I right, Doug Chapin, to say in some states convicted felons are prevented from voting? In some states, it depends.
Exactly. It depends. The treatment of felons varies from state to state, and these new statewide databases that states are developing as a result of the Help America Vote Act should help to address that. But those solutions are probably more in the future than the present right now.
So it could still be a problem this time around.
I think it could be. I think what we saw in Florida in the last several weeks is a prime example of the nation moving its focus from sort of large-scale issues in election administration to micro-issues. People worried not just about what machines will be used, but how individual voters will be treated at the polls. And the more we focus on that, the more things like felon voting and statewide databases and voter lists and provisional voting will be hot-button issues in the weeks leading up to November.
Dave, thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be checking up on all of these issues again before Election Day, I'm sure, and let's not hope afterwards. Thanks to both of our guests, Paul DiGregorio, Commissioner of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, an independent bipartisan agency created by the Help America Vote Act. And what's that website where people can go look at your report?
EAC.gov.
And thanks very much for joining us here in Studio 3A. Doug Chapin, have a good time on the rest of your vacation.
Much.
Doug Chapin joined us from Minnesota Public Radio.